From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Are there any numbers of examples of lewd smilers? Ozzy Osbourne, in the old days, used to smile presumably to annoy people like Tipper Gore.
The history of the many-splendored smile, later this hour. Today, a close look at happiness, from who's happy and why to a crisis in American well-being. Also, a screenwriter searches for hope in the rubble of despair.
What I wanted to know on Grumps is that you realize that life is very fragile, that you can suddenly lose someone you love and that you must take care.
And why taking an up-close look at death just might unlock the door to happiness and contentment in life.
I do an exercise of having somebody actually imagine their death and imagine it as viscerally as they can. Every time I've ever done that with anyone in therapy or in a meditation class, always people's response is to be more loving.
So what is the secret to happiness? Well, it turns out science still doesn't know. Dave Myers teaches psychology at Hope College. He says there's a growing body of research in happiness studies, which is chipping away at one of life's greatest riddles. What makes for a happy life? He says some of the newest research tells us humans are hopelessly inept at something called forecasting, the ability to predict our future happiness.
We have great difficulty forecasting our happiness. When people think about how they'd be affected by good things like warmer winters, a football victory, maybe losing weight, more television channels, they overestimate the extent to which their positive emotions will endure. And likewise, if something bad happens, even very bad, you don't get tenure or you suffer a significant disability, the bad effects of that are shorter lived than most people expect. Emotions have a shorter half-life than most people predict. And my colleagues Dan Gilbert and Tim Wilson have referred to this as the durability bias. We tend to think emotions are more durable than they really are.
How do you study this? Can you give me an example of the way in which you would test it?
Well, for example, people coming up for tenure have been asked how enduringly significant it would be to them if they do or don't get tenure, or people who are about to receive the outcome of an HIV test are asked to predict what their emotions will be. And then if you go back to people who some years before did or did not receive tenure to find out whether indeed, as people predict, those who did not receive tenure were lastingly devastated, you find that, surprisingly, the people who didn't get tenure and those who did are doing about equally well emotionally. And likewise, people who've been struck by some physical tragedy, even being declared HIV positive, find that although they're distraught for a while, emotions tend to rebound sooner than you might predict. Weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes in the morning, reflected the psalmist. And by the way, that's kind of reassuring news for people like myself. I live with progressive hearing loss. I'm on a trajectory toward the complete deafness that marked my mother's life. And so I take some reassurance from these studies that show that even people struck by disabilities manage to adapt and emotions tend to rebound.
Things aren't going to be nearly as bad as we thought. Is that true across the board? These situations you've described tend to be, they look anyway, like big things in your life. There seems to be some similarity to research I've seen in the past that suggests, you know, I'll be happy if I buy that red tie. I'll be happy if my kid gets Tickle Me Elmo for Christmas, none of which generally proves to be true.
Yes, if only, you know, we get what we're longing or lusting for, then we will be happy. Usually, we're living with an illusion. And in fact, getting a raise does make people happier, but not for long. Again, that's the durability bias. Even, by the way, people who've lived through the Holocaust have turned out to be, at least the American immigrants who were Holocaust survivors, to be an amazingly resilient and healthy and thriving group. That's not to say that there's nothing so terrible that would have no lasting effect. Rape survivors, for example, live enduringly with the after effects of that trauma and are haunted by that, by the haunting memories of that trauma. But by and large, we cope very well. We are a very adaptive species.
Is this counterintuitive in some ways? In looking through some of the examples in your research or research on the subject, I came across things like, oh, somebody was asked, would you rather have a trick knee or a broken leg, for instance? And people said, oh, I'd rather have a trick knee because a broken leg would be so painful.
Right. But a broken leg, one gets over, and a trick knee may go on and on and on. It may become part of that nagging pain that's part of everyday life. I think it is surprising because people are not very accurate at predicting their emotions. And it's also rather surprising to many people that the very good thing over time of increased affluence and all the technology and comfort that it buys has had no effect on the well-being of Americans or Western Europeans, for example. We today have more than twice the personal disposable, that's after-tax income, of people 40 and 45 years ago. We have all the technology. We have air conditioning in our homes, which they didn't have. We have email and post-it notes and garage door openers and phone answering machines. I love it. I wouldn't want to be without any of it. And yet, people are no happier today than they were 40 years ago. In fact, if anything, they're slightly more likely to be depressed. Our teens are more likely to commit suicide. So the rising economic tide has definitely not lifted us emotionally.
Intuitively, I would suggest to you that there must be some level at which that problem begins. Below that level, a little money would make an awful lot of difference. The money
yes.
to have a house and a roof
yes.
over your head, enough
yes.
to eat, clothes to wear.
And when you get that, you also get a certain measure of control over your life. And that is a predictor of happiness. People who feel in control of their lives live with greater happiness than people who feel like their lives are out of control. So there is a modest correlation between income and happiness, but only up to a point. And we've seen this in data from Australia as well, too. When you go from the bottom tenth to about the third tenth or decile of income, there's some increase in happiness, but you get diminishing returns after that.
You know, one of the things this seemed to suggest is that we tend to intellectually define happiness as coming in big leaps and bounds. But in fact, we live pretty much once you get to a certain level, it's not the big changes that make a difference, it's the little ones.
Right. And then the other things come into play. Assuming you have some control over your life and you have enough to meet life's basic necessities, such as close, supportive, enduring, committed relationships. People who have intimate soulmate friends are happier than people who don't. 40% of married Americans over the last quarter century have reported themselves very happy in repeated surveys by the National Opinion Research Center, as have only 22% of never married Americans, marriage being an example of a close, enduring partnership for many people. So what we call social support or close relationships, that's a big predictor of happiness among two or three such predictors.
Do most Americans think they are happy?
Interestingly, most books about happiness will tell you that few people are genuinely happy. These books, however, are mostly written by mental health workers who spend their days with deeply unhappy people. If
yes.
you go, in fact, to the average American or random samples of Americans, you find that 6 in 10 say they're pretty happy. 3 in 10 say they're very happy. Only 1 in 10 say they're not very happy. Most people are reasonably happy, and it's the occasionally miserable ones. And for all of us, that's misery strikes us occasionally, but that's not the normal human condition.
It's funny looking at it, isn't it? I mean, if you watch television, you see that there is more and more advertising done for antidepressants. In fact, people seem to talk more and more about being depressed, and we see indications that many people are being medicated for depression. That would suggest that people are less happy.
But that could be true. That is, it could be simultaneously true that there's somewhat more depressed people today than there was a half century ago, despite increased affluence, as we noted earlier. And yet, that's still a small percentage. And it is still the case today, as it was a half century ago, that overwhelmingly, people, 9 in 10 people, describe themselves as pretty or very happy.
Dave Myers teaches psychology at Hope College. Take a glance at a photo album or stroll through an art gallery, and one thing is certain, a smiling face is captivating. Angus Trumbull should know. He's the curator of painting and sculpture at the Yale Center for British Art in New Haven, Connecticut. Trumbull studied centuries of painted smiles for his new book called A Brief History of the Smile. He told Steve Paulson the big smile occupies a special place in the world of art.
In the time-honored manner, the more you look, the more open mouths you find. And in fact, what was so interesting is that very frequently teeth and open-mouthed expressions belong to lunatics, monsters, the damned, people undergoing experiences of religious ecstasy, and tax collectors.
What happens when you look back at the art over previous centuries and how painters depicted smiles? What do you see?
One finds, of course, a certain number of iconic smilers, such as, you know, the famous Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci in the Louvre. One has similar, very famous images like the Laughing Cavalier by Franz Hals in the Wallace Collection in London. But when I started looking into these, it seemed to me that these were exceptions that proved the rule, that in fact smiling faces were very rare. And indeed, the Mona Lisa, for example, is notable for the fact that the smile that we see hovering over the lips of this mysterious woman is very much the creation of critics working and writing in France in the 19th century. In other words, up to a point there were many remarkable things about the painting, but the smile was not given its privileged place that it has been given in our time since the mid-19th century.
Now, one thing that's striking to me is when you get into the last century, not only do you have more smiles, you have more open mouths, and also you have toothy smiles. And in fact, that seems to be the best smile of all, is if you can smile, if you look genuine, and if you can, I don't know, seem natural and you have nice teeth to boot.
Yes, and the nice teeth part is the other crucial technical development, I think, that led to this. I mean, the dramatic improvement of basic dental hygiene that took place in the 19th century led to very substantial improvement in the general health and size and shape and disposition of people's teeth. You can see the change in early cinema. You know, early heroines of the silent screen tend to have small mouths, or at least the effect of makeup accentuate the idea of a small sort of Cupid's bow lips. And it's not until you get great stars like Rita Hayworth, where the sunny, open, broad smile that we recognize among current stars like Julia Roberts, this becomes the standard. And indeed, in fact, in the scientific and behavioral science literature, you have nowadays the standard against which smiling is measured tends to be much, much more the broadest possible grin with the mouth open and exposing both rows of teeth. In other words, anything that is less vigorous than that is regarded as somehow falling short of a true smile. And that, I think, represents a fundamental change in the last 100 years.
And that's how we're supposed to have our pictures taken now. And I know from experience, because people are always telling me to smile with my mouth open, and I don't know, it never looks natural to me. But that's the standard. If you can't do that, there's something wrong with you.
Well, it's true. And have you ever been asked to say cheese?
Of course, a million times.
Well, this is a very interesting part of my investigation. I became sort of interested in what people say in other languages, whether in fact, you know, asking people to say cheese happens universally at a certain date. When were people expected to wear an expression of, you know, a broad, frank grin in a photograph? And it seems to be almost simultaneously in many different places in around about 1920. And cheese comes from, in fact, English public schoolboys. but there are equivalents in other languages, and most of them are foodstuffs, interestingly.
So what are some of the words that other cultures use?
In Korea, it's kimchi, which is cabbage, fermented cabbage. In Spain, they say patata, which is, of course, potato. In Finland, they say myukku, which is a kind of fish. There are many, many other examples. You know, the question is then of pronunciation. There are some which seem to produce the most extraordinary facial expressions, like the Persian Farsi speakers apparently say holu, which just seems to me to purse the lips into a kind of, you know, a zero shape, which seems to militate against a smile. But I must confess that I may not have the correct pronunciation.
Now, you write in your book about some rather bizarre practices of smiling. There was something called the grinning match in the British Isles. What was that all about?
Well, the grinning match is a most remarkable phenomenon. These contests, which still exist today in parts of the north of England and the Lake District, also known as gurning, these are sort of bizarre face-making contests. And they certainly existed by the 18th century and therefore most probably existed for a long time before that. And for people without teeth, of course, this is a relatively easy thing to achieve, a range of really truly bizarre faces. The mandible can be jutted forward and sort of, you know, the rest of the face kind of sucked into the mouth, and all sorts of grotesque faces can be achieved. This was done also through a horse's collar or a yoke. And it was an activity that was, I'm sure, accompanied by, well, we know it was accompanied by a good deal of drinking and drunken acclamation at race meetings and in taverns and other kind of public settings.
But that's just the very idea that there would be these grinning matches, these competitions to outdo your opponent with the most grotesque smile possible. It's kind of strange.
It's very strange, and it's very suggestive, and it belongs in, I think, that same family of lewd and licentious behaviours. Of course, lewdness and licentiousness today are, you know, to some degree, harness some of the power of the smile as well. I mean, look at people like Johnny Rotten or Divine. I mean, there are any number of examples of lewd smilers. Ozzy Osbourne in the old days used to smile presumably to annoy people like Tipper Gore and the Washington Mothers. But one felt that their smiles were part of their kind of transgressive performance. And, I mean, one is naturally intrigued, even though it's hard to see it happening on stage from the back of the mosh pit.
One last question. I notice in the photo in the dust cover of your book, you're smiling, but your mouth is closed. I assume that was a conscious choice?
I have to confess to you that I have terrible teeth. And so yes, it's partly choice. Of course, when that photograph was taken, I wasn't aware that it would go on the dust jacket of a book about the history of smiling. And perhaps I might have made different choices had I known. But I suppose when I'm photographed, I tend to smile with my mouth closed because I'm conscious of the fact that my teeth are relatively small and somewhat discoloured. So I was assured recently by a particularly unselfconscious niece. And so I suppose, subconsciously I tend to sort of conceal them. I'm hoping that my book will do sufficiently well that I can afford to do something about this.
Angus Trumbull is the author of A Brief History of the Smile and the curator of paintings and sculpture at the Yale Center for British Art in New Haven, Connecticut.
When you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
and the whole world smiles with you.
Smiles.
And when you're laughing,
when you're laughing,
oh, you're laughing,
oh, you're laughing.
Mm, when the sun comes
shining through.
When you're crying, you bring on the rain.
Stop your sighing.
Won't you be happy again? When you're smiling, keep on smiling, and the world will smile.
Coming up, if life is so good, how come so many of us feel so bad?
as societies, United States and Western Europe, have gambled a great deal on the concept that money could buy happiness, that by increasing society's affluence, we would make society a happier place. And it's, if anybody ever doubted, the proof is now in. Money does not buy happiness.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Life in a wealthy Western country is good, isn't it? At least it should be, according to Greg Easterbrook. Easterbrook is the author of a book called The Progress Paradox. That's the name he gives to the fact that Americans are better off than ever before, but more dissatisfied than ever. Easterbrook explained his idea for Enstrain Chimps.
By any objective measure that you'd choose, the country is dramatically improved, certainly not for everybody, but for most people during the post-war era. Living standards are the most obvious. Typical house size has doubled in the past 50 years. The typical family has gone from owning one car to owning three. College graduation has gone from being a rare event, typically only one person in an extended family was a college graduate, to being a common event. Two-thirds of high school graduates now go on to college. Healthcare outcomes are improving across the board, longer longevity, lower rates of almost all diseases, including lower rates of most cancers. Crime is declining. Pollution is declining in all categories except greenhouse gases. Personal freedom has never been higher. The decline of discrimination, not eliminated, of course, but declined. And personal freedom for women especially, but for all Americans, I think, has never been greater than it is today.
Is this completely indisputable? Because I think if you asked an awful lot of people, are you better off today than your parents or your grandparents were, a lot of people would say no, and the world's getting worse.
Well, and that's the progress paradox. When people are polled on these questions, Americans clearly don't believe that they're better off. The polling data on this goes back to the late 1990s, before 9/11 became a factor. Americans said by about a two-thirds majority that they thought they had it worse than their parents did and that they expected their children to have it worse still. So the disconnect between the fact that virtually all objective indicators are positive and the fact that most Americans don't believe they're positive and don't feel particularly good about it is the progress paradox.
Well, what about the part when you ask people about their lifestyles and when you ask researchers about Americans' lifestyles and they say Americans are working harder today than they did generations before. They have fewer vacations. They spend less time with their children. We live with a constant threat of terrorism. The environment's going to hell and the economy's not doing so well.
Well, that's a lot of subjects. Let's take them in turn. The economy, I think, people are worried on two fronts. One, globalization has created a form of job anxiety that I think is much more pronounced than perhaps, say, for our parents' generation. I think the biggest single problem the current economy equates, well, actually there are two, is inequality and second, job anxiety, even for people whose incomes now are perfectly fine. On environment, with the exception of greenhouse gases, all trends are positive and have been for decades. Smog is down by one-third in the last 30 years, even though the population has increased in that period. Acid rain is down 60%. Toxic emissions of all forms are down almost 70%. Water pollution has declined pretty much across the board with a big exception of greenhouse gases. Trends are favorable. What are the other subject areas you mentioned? I'll tick off the stats there, too.
The threat of global terrorism?
Oh, well, this, of course, is a big change. It's of concern for everybody, and it relates to what I call in the book collapse anxiety, and that is the fear, I think, that many of us entertain that even though life is good for most people, certainly not all, I always say, but for most people in the United States today, that some imposed factor, whether it's resource collapse or terrorism or anarchy or runaway population growth, or there'll be something that causes the Western system to crash. I think there's one reason why people don't feel better about the current moment.
So you're painting a picture of a society in which things have really gotten steadily better and in which life, by almost any measure, is really pretty good. And yet most psychologists and social scientists will tell you we're living in the midst of a kind of epidemic of depression. So why is everybody unhappy?
Yeah, well, it's clear that people don't feel any better about their circumstances than they did, let's say, a generation ago. The percentage of Americans who describe themselves as happy has not increased since 1950. And depending on whose estimate you believe, the incidence of clinical depression adjusted for population growth is 3 to 10 times more prevalent today than it was 50 years ago. And this is true both in the United States and in Western Europe. There are a number of possibilities. I think one is excessive materialism. In my book, I call this the revenge of the credit card, that not having something, desiring a BMW, say, and not having it, clearly makes some people unhappy. But if your income increases and you then get the BMW, that doesn't make you happy. Psychological research is pretty clear that material things beyond the basic level that we all need a home, we all need clothes, healthcare, and so on. Once you reach that basic level, and it's at the lower rung of lower middle class in income terms, money and happiness decouple and cease to have anything to do with each other. The Forbes 400, the richest people in the country, have been studied. They are no happier than the population as a whole. And I think as societies, the United States and Western Europe, have gambled a great deal on the concept that money could buy happiness, that by increasing society's affluence, we would make society a happier place. And it's, if anybody ever doubted, the proof is now in. Money does not buy happiness.
I don't understand why you suggest in the book that, in fact, having more stuff tends to make people unhappier. I mean, you talk, for instance, about the oppression of catalogs.
Yes, I call this catalog-induced anxiety. Well, I think in the modern age, there are so many glittering and gleaming things in the world to buy, and our society is very good at producing them. And between catalogs and the internet and television shows, we know in great detail all the things that we will never possess. If you think about an average person of, let's say, 100 years ago, an average person certainly would have known that the Astors and the Rockefellers existed at some level of wealth and opulence, but they wouldn't have known the details. Today, we know the details of the lives of the rich and famous. If you want to, Bill Gates lives in a 66,000 square foot house, and if you would like to see the floor plans, you can easily download them from the internet. All the shining and expensive stuff that you and I will never own, we can see in extraordinary detail. And this induces in a lot of people a feeling that what they themselves possess is not adequate, even though most people, you know, pretty nice house, decent clothes, et cetera. It just engenders an inadequacy regarding what you yourself have accomplished.
Does this suggest that as a culture, we're all suffering from a kind of learned pessimism for various reasons, some of them just cultural, structural? We've all grown up being trained, in a sense, to be pessimistic.
Well, in my book, I call this abundance denial. I think we have a psychological compensation mechanism of most of us denying that we live well, partly because through history, most of the people who have lived well have gotten their good fortune through a rigged economic system. The system's pretty fair and open now, but we all know examples from history of people who ended up where they were without really deserving to. But if you look at polling data, when researchers ask people how much money is required to live well, we ask Americans, they always estimate twice as much as they earn. So if you earn 25,000, you say 50,000 would be necessary. If you earn 50, you say 100. A person who earns $1 million a year says that $2 million a year would be necessary. It indicates sort of structural dissatisfaction, but also this thing that I call abundance denial, of the desire to deny that we're living well, even when the majority of Americans, certainly not everybody, but the majority are. I think we've made a mistake, an underlying mistake, with too much materialism, and I think it's a mistake that people are gradually going to catch on to, although I admit I could be wrong about that.
This doesn't seem, I don't know, pathetic to you somehow, that you've got people who are living better than any other generation in the history of the entire planet, and yet more and more people than ever before are complaining and unhappy about their lives?
Well, I guess I'd say this. There are an awful lot of people who are pretty well off by objective standards who pause at the doors of their SUVs to complain about how they've been mistreated in life, or then roar off to a fancy dinner somewhere. I would rather have millions of people who are materially comfortable and complaining about it than all the other possible outcomes. There, you know, there are 1.2 billion people living at the level of destitution in this world, and their problems are so much greater than ours that I'd rather that they were in the same situation, well off and complaining about it. I guess I'm just trying to get across in this book, among other things, the reasons why we should feel grateful for our good fortune, how we should place it in perspective, and how a sense of gratitude for our good fortune would improve our own well-being and our own experience of our lives.
Greg Easterbrook is the author of The Progress Paradox. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps.
It makes you happy. It can't be that bad. If it makes you happy, then why the hell are you so sad? If it makes you happy, it can't be that bad. If it makes you happy, then why the hell are you so sad?
If you'd like more information on The Progress Paradox, or any of the books mentioned this hour, stop by our website. It's www.ttbook.org. Drop us a comment while you're there. We'd love to hear from you. Still to come this hour, why coming to terms with death might be the ticket to a happy life.
Buddhists have a remarkable kind of tradition of really valuing facing impermanence. You know, in the time of the Buddha, he used to send monks off to the charnel grounds of India to meditate and imagine as they would watch, you know, bodies in various stages of either being burnt or decomposition, they would think, this could be me.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
They say we all lose 21 grams at the exact moment of our death. Everyone, 21 grams. The weight of a stack of 5 nickels. The weight of a chocolate bar. The weight of a hummingbird.
There's a fine line between hope and despair. And that's where you'll find Mexican author Guillermo Arriaga. He wrote the screenplay for Amores Perros and the critically acclaimed film 21 Grams. 21 Grams tells the story of three people whose lives intersect after a tragic accident. Jack, played by Benicio del Toro, plays a born-again Christian who kills a man and his two daughters in a car accident. Naomi Watts plays Christina, the widow who loses her whole family. And Sean Penn is Paul, a mathematician slowly dying of heart disease. Arriaga told Steve Paulson where the idea for 21 grams came from.
First of all, I have a car accident that happened when we were in a mountain in Mexico, and I was sleeping when it happened. We fall into a cliff, a very deep cliff, and so it was very terrifying. And then I think that dying in a car accident is the most stupidest way of dying. It's like if technology is taking revenge of you because humans is trying to go too farther against nature and technology is like it goes against human. And then car accidents, they put in touch a lot of people that without car accident they will not know each other, never. So that's why I'm, like, obsessed with car accidents.
Hmm. So in the accident that you were in, there were people who were killed in that accident?
No. No, I was the only one injured. I lost all the bones in my nose and have a fracture in my head. But no one was killed.
Where did the idea for writing 21 grams come from?
Well, I once was living in a city called Leon, here in Mexico. And I work in a university that was in the outskirts of the city. And once, one Friday, my wife was giving me a party for my birthday. But I was running late for my birthday party. So I went home and I had to take a road. And suddenly I saw a patrol car with the lights on. And I stopped because that's the way that many students take home and try to check no one has an accident. And there was a man lying dead beside the road. So one policeman pulled out his wallet to see the name of this guy. And there was a photograph of him with his wife and a little girl sitting on his lap, everyone smiling. And I say, this girl and this woman has lost a father and a husband, and they don't know it. And this man is never going to see them again. So I went back to my car, and I was thinking on the way to my birthday party, what about if I tell my wife that I killed someone the moment I arrived to my birthday party?
Hey, guys, we're home.
Daddy, what'd you bring us?
I brought you a kiss.
You didn't bring me a present, huh?
No, just a kiss.
We made you a cake.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Freddie put the icing on it.
Mommy made the cake.
Come here. Freddie, are you going to say hello to your father?
Come look at the cake, Daddy.
Freddie drew those for you.
I drew those ones.
You say 21 grams is the amount of weight a human being loses when he or she dies. It's a very poetic idea, but there's also a suggestion that something happens to the soul at the moment of death. Is 21 grams a spiritual film?
Well, I must tell you, I'm an atheist. What I wanted to make is a statement that is here in this life where you have hell or heaven. And I don't think you have another chance to live. Everything stops when you die. So the statement of 21 grams is you must love and you must take care of the people that surrounds you. There's no other chance. And when you die, it's not that those 21 grams becomes your soul. It's the weight the other ones carry, the ones that survive carry when someone dies. It's a matter of how that 21 grams still hurts the people that remains living.
It's so interesting to hear you say that you're an atheist because your movie is full of religious imagery. And of course, one of your main characters, Jack, played by Benicio del Toro, is a born-again Christian who struggles with God, with his faith in God throughout the entire film. And was it hard for you to write about this man if you're an atheist?
No, it wasn't hard because he was obsessed, and I'm a very obsessive person. So it wasn't very hard to understand him. And I like it because I have some distance from him, so I can see his religious obsessions in a better way, because I don't think he's a religious man. I think he is this kind of fanatical people who are sick by religion, but they are not religious.
But tell me, what's going to happen if you shoot a pregnant woman or an old man, huh? You know what'll happen? The guilt will suck you down to the bone. Stealing ain't worth it. Going to church, reading the Bible, and believing in Jesus, brother, that's your ticket.
Well, and it's interesting what you've done in this movie because two of the main characters seem to have overcome major obstacles in their lives. Benicio del Toro, the character he plays, Jack, has had a history of problems with the law, of thievery and robbery and all that kind of thing. But he seems to have turned his life around. And then this horrible thing happens, this car accident. And then the Naomi Watts character has had a problem with drug addiction. But she seems to have turned her life around. She's married, happy, has children, and then this horrible accident happens and her family is wiped out and she's left to deal with it. You seem to be saying that even if you play by the rules, that's not enough. Terrible things can still happen to you.
What I wanted is not only Naomi and Benicio's character, but also Sean Penn. It's like they are coming from very deep hells. One from jail. Naomi comes from drug addiction, and Sean Penn comes from the hell of bad health.
He has a terminal illness.
He has a terminal illness. And the three of them, they think they have just arrived to heaven. Benicio through Jesus, Naomi through her family, and Sean Penn through a new heart. And they feel, we are done, everything's fine. And what I like is to see how these people go back to deeper hells, and how the human will and the power of love and the power of human nature has enough strength to go back, to recover themselves through a very hard road. Because I think that hope is there. It's difficult to find, but there is always hope. And this is the message of this film, is there is always hope. There is always something or someone to struggle for. That's why I wanted the three of them coming from hell, then going to heaven, going back to hell, and then back to heaven.
Well, Paul, the character played by Sean Penn, sacrifices himself at the end of the movie, so the other two characters can be saved. And it seems like you're playing with some pretty obvious Christian symbolism here. I mean, you can't help thinking about Jesus, what he did. But yet, you've said you're an atheist.
Yeah, that's what I love about this film. It's written by an atheist. It's directed by a religious man. And it can go either way. It can be very simple, earth-feel movie that you are here, or it can be a very soulful religious movie at the same time.
Now, one thing that struck me as I was watching the movie 21 Grams is there's that phrase, it's said by two different characters, I think, at different points in the movie, and life goes on. I mean, they've gone through horrible things, mm-hmm. but then there's, and life goes on. Is that a message of hope?
Yeah, that's a message of hope, particularly to my son, Santiago. My sister-in-law, she have a two-year-old son who fell on a swimming pool. No one noticed it until he was dead. And it was a terrible tragedy. 5 years later, my sister-in-law, she smiled again. Life went on. And my son Santiago, who was five at that time, who didn't knew his cousin, but knew what happened, asked me, "Dad, if I die, will you ever smile again?" I was shocked by his question. So the motivation to write this film is trying to say something about life to my own kids. And then my son, when after September 11, I went to New York, and I called him from the cell phone, telling him, "Look, I'm in New York." I began describing him the buildings and everything, and he said, "Are the people still crying?" And I say, "No, life goes on, my dear. Life has power. Life has..." So this is a way to answer my own kids. It's funny, but sometimes you make films or you write books to tell something to someone in particular. In this case, it was for my children. And the life goes on is for them.
Guillermo Arriaga wrote the screenplay for the movie 21 Grams. He joined Steve Paulson by phone from Mexico City.
Long face pulling down, don't hide away.
While movies like 21 Grams can help us appreciate life, Lauren Ladner has another method for finding happiness. Ladner is a psychologist, a practicing Buddhist, and the author of a book called The Lost Art of Compassion. Ladner says coming to terms with death can bring about a new appreciation of life. In fact, Ladner helps his patients visualize their own deaths in detail. He told me why the technique works.
When people don't come to terms with the inevitability of their impermanence and death, then they often don't focus on what's most important in life, then miss out oftentimes on what's most important. Just last week, I was down in Florida doing a reading and met with a very old friend, actually the best friend of my father from college. And he had recently recovered from cancer. And I was reading about this point, and he came up to me with tears in his eyes, really, and said, you know, until I realized I was going to die, I hadn't started living. I hadn't focused on what was most important, was what he was saying. And he said it with such heartfelt intensity, and really that's the quality that comes across. When people face their impermanence, there's a quality of heartfulness and of engagement with life that just isn't there otherwise.
You know, what's so odd about it, I guess, is that we seem as a culture, I think, to believe that we're going to go on forever.
I agree. I think our culture really avoids these issues to a remarkable extent, you know, maybe more than almost any other culture, at least any other culture I'm aware of. My own awareness of these kinds of issues really came from travels in India and Nepal and familiarity with some Asian cultures, particularly, Buddhist and Hindu masters who used to go and sit and watch, you know, bodies in the charnel grounds. And when I myself went to India, I remember going to the Ganges and watching as they would burn the bodies and then spread the ashes over the holy river there. And my goodness, as an American, you know, I'd never seen something like that.
But what do we do? I mean, it seems kind of morbid to think about your own death, doesn't it?
I think that's the way Americans almost always react, is feeling as though it would be morbid and as though it would sort of get them down, I guess. But my experience has been that the opposite is true. I do an exercise like this, you know, of having somebody actually imagine their death and imagine it as viscerally as they can. And first of all, actually every time I've ever done that with anyone in therapy or in a meditation class, always people's response is to be more loving. Not long ago, I was doing this with a guy who had been an athlete. You know, he did this and then was thinking about his family and love. The next week when I saw him, he came into the office and he said that in his office he had had all these trophies up from his old days in high school as an athlete. And after doing this exercise, he ripped them all down and put up pictures of his kids. And there was this quality, really, of just connecting with his loving, you know, with what was most essential to him. It didn't matter about the past and about some achievement he had had in high school. What mattered was being loving and his role as a father and caring, you know. And that's almost always what comes out when people do this sort of exercise.
So how do you do this? When you go with a person, an individual or a group, how do you work with them to confront mortality?
What I often do is to have people literally sort of, you know, start off by kind of taking a few deep breaths and focusing their mind, but then to really imagine a time in the future. Usually I suggest a few months down the road. I have them actually choose a method, you know, to imagine oftentimes the first time because it's a little, to give them more time. I suggest thinking of laying in bed, you know, with their family around them and really just dissolving, you know, watching the process of their, you know, no longer being able to talk and realizing that this is the last time they'll say something to those people, realizing this is the last time they'll see their home and that all these things are going to be left behind. And I really go into as much detail and try to make it as visceral as I can with the person because we have so much defense against this. What almost always happens is that the person realizes, you know, and then what I'll do is at the moment, just before imagining actually dying, I'll have them think back over their life and think, what mattered? And when they do that, of course, the answer is love, you know. And I'll say, when people actually do this exercise, what they almost always tell me is that the next day, you know, they couldn't let their wife or husband leave the house without saying they love them. And they couldn't let their kids, you know, they just had to kind of share or give of themselves. Often I think of the old movie of A Christmas Carol, in which Scrooge, you know, thought he had died, you know, had the vision of his own death, and then he wakes up on Christmas morning, and that actor grabs his body and says, "I'm alive, I'm alive," and immediately, of course, he runs to the window and says, "Buy this and buy a turkey," you know, he wants to give everything away.
Right.
And I often, you know, my experience with people has been that, you know, that actor, of course, does it very well as an actor, but the point I'm getting is that. That's really the energy that people get. You know, that energy that he had that morning. In theory, we could all have that energy every day, waking up and thinking, what can I do? How can I give of myself today? Hmm. But that energy really only comes from this awareness.
When did you discover this? How did you get started on this?
I myself was first exposed to these ideas through Buddhist practice. You know, in college, I'd started to study Buddhism and then studied with some Tibetan Buddhist teachers. Buddhists have a remarkable kind of tradition of really valuing facing impermanence. You know, in the time of the Buddha, he used to send monks off to the charnel grounds of India to meditate and imagine as they would watch, you know, bodies in various stages of either being burnt or decomposition, they would think, this could be me. Now, that's a, you know, obviously a very visceral way. And Tibetans have a cultural, you know, they don't have charnel grounds like India, but because the ground there is often frozen and there's not much firewood, they have a custom of sky burial, where literally there's someone who kind of chops up bodies and feeds them to the vultures. Pretty extreme form.
Wow.
And some of these Tibetan lamas would literally go and meditate watching that process and think, you know, and talk about facing impermanence. My goodness, they really face it very viscerally.
Well, it quite literally separates body from soul at that point. You're thinking the meat.
Yeah, it really is that. And even reminds me of the first Dalai Lama. You know, the current Dalai Lama is the 14th, and the first in the line of Dalai Lamas. They say that he actually went to one of these places when he was young and did a retreat like that. And through the force of his realizing impermanence, you know, he became this great teacher of loving compassion, famous throughout all of Central Asia. And when he was an older man, they asked him to build a monastery. And he said he would only build one if they would allow him to build it on the exact spot. There's a stone where they would chop up the bodies. And he said he wanted to build a monastery so that his own throne would be directly behind that stone. So he would have to step over it each day if he was going to teach. So that he would remember the purpose of teaching. You know, it wasn't just for his ego or to kind of aggrandize himself. It was to take the essence of that moment, to connect with his audience and to really share something of himself, of love, you know, and of compassion. And then, of course, when people had to come up for a blessing or to talk with him, they also had to step over that stone.
Well, you talk about it, it's almost as though death is a kind of gift.
Yeah, it teaches us how to live. I always remember one of my favorite quotes from all of literature was Thoreau, who said, you know, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately and to front out only the essential facts of life, and not when I came to die discover I had not lived. And to me, that is what death, the awareness of death, gives us, is it makes sure that we live while we have the chance.
Lauren Ladner is the author of the book The Lost Art of Compassion. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Doug Gordon, with engineering help from Marv Nunn. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Happy Happy Joy Joy, number 222B. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email at ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Adventure writer Ann Jones recalls crossing Africa from Tangier to Cape Town in search of one special tribe, guided by the feminine principles of compromise, tolerance, and peace. We'll hear about a Frenchman who never went further than his window. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Journeys Great and Small. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.